welcome to another episode of Meet Me in the Middle. It is May 31st, the day after Game 7. And boy, was it a Game 7, huh?
It was a Game 7. They played 6 before it, and this was the 7th.
Yep. This is definitely categorically, statistically, and actually a Game 7. This is Xander Fridley, by the way, just a regular guy.
This is the Mr. Fantastic, incredibly handsome Hunter York.
Yeah. So, we're going to start off with something that needs to be covered before you can cover Game 7. Because it was Game 6. Game 6 was, once again another do-or-die scenario for the Warriors. They were in OKC. And for three quarters, it was not looking good. The Warriors were consistently down, as in they were always down, by, I want to say, no fewer than 6 points. Oklahoma City was not dominating the game, but they were definitely controlling the pace. They were looking really good. Right? I mean, it was a very...
Well, yeah. I thought that if they were going to put it away in either Game 6 or 7, it was going to be Game 6. I thought that, I guess you could say the big two with Westbrook and Durant were really doing a good job of involving the other players to get some... get some points that otherwise would just be wild shots taken by Westbrook or Durant. And that I thought Golden State would win the game in the end. That was mainly my hopefulness,
right?
To see a Game 7. But at the same time, this has been a really incredible series. And it's been...
Well, it's a really incredible series.
Yeah. It was hard to watch and appreciate everything that was going on in the moment. I think we'll appreciate this series when the playoffs are over. Because what happened in this series is we saw the big two in Westbrook and Durant almost finally win some big games.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the Warriors prove to everyone that even when they're up against the wall, when it looks impossible, they are still the best team in the league, especially at the end of quarters.
Mm-hmm. End of quarters and end of games, as in the fourth quarter, because we marched into the fourth quarter, and things were not looking, as we said, things were not looking great for the Warriors, but during that fourth quarter, what it seemed to me, actually, you got down to it, and it was really, they were down by 7 with 5 minutes left. And here are the numbers right here. Let me get to them. In the last 4:40 of Game 6, 4 minutes and 40 seconds, the Warriors scored 16 points. The Thunder scored 4. The Warriors were 5 of 9. The Thunder were 1 of 5. From 3-point line, the Warriors were 3 of 5. The Thunder did not make a 3-pointer. The Warriors had 0 turnovers, the Thunder had 6, and off of those 6 turnovers, the Warriors scored 10 points. It just comes down to, in the last 5 minutes of that game, the Thunder looked like the Thunder we had seen all regular season when they had blown a NBA record number of fourth quarter leads.
Well, if I'm correct, and I could be wrong about the exact minute-wise, but Westbrook had 4 turnovers in the last minute 40 of Game 6. That's incredible.
Yeah, in 90 seconds, he had 4 turnovers. He had the dribble off of his leg when he was fouled by Draymond Green, but the dribble still went out of bounds. He had the bad inbounds pass that was stolen by Curry. He was stripped by Andre Iguodala, who was a main reason why the Warriors won that game. Because his lockdown defense during that last... 5 minutes really just was incredible. And the last one was, he turned it over on the inbounds pass after that first one he missed. Because, he just wanted to make sure that things were sealed off.
Well, and I think that we just saw how good Thompson really is. Klay Thompson.
Klay Thompson, yes, I mean, in game six.
We already knew he was good, but, you know, he's always kind of been second fiddle to Curry. And, you know, rightfully so. Steph Curry is Steph Curry.
Mm-hmm.
But Thompson was one of the main offensive forces, both in game six to come back and win, and when we get to game seven, he was a huge factor. And Curry, obviously, but Thompson was picking up the slack when Curry was playing very bad.
Well, I have his three-point chart from game six right here in front of me, where he made an NBA playoff record, 11 threes in one game. He was, I have it in quadrants here, so you have the two corners. He didn't shoot any from the left corner, and he was 50% from the right corner, one of two. And then I have the bottom right, left. He was 4 of 5, 80% from one corner, 55% from another. And then from dead on, he was 50%. He was shooting incredibly all game long. And he ended up with 41 points. Now, here's a stat. All right. In the fourth quarter, Curry and Thompson had 27 of the Warriors' 33 points. Combined, they made 16 three-pointers in the game. And they scored or assisted on 82 out of the Warriors' 108 points in that game.
Man.
82 out of 100.
It's just hard to believe that, you know, like 15 years ago, the league was dominated by big men.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got two guys. I think Thompson's fairly tall. Curry's not that tall. And they're just taking threes from, I mean, they're standing in the middle of the ocean trying to hit the beach. And they're making it. I mean, they're right. So far out. And just, it's hard to appreciate it because we haven't really seen any three-point shooters as good as them. Both of them.
Right.
I mean, Ray Allen, Rashard Lewis, those are good players, but I don't think they compare to these guys.
Well, sheer volume and the way that they get their shots is what separates them from, like, the Ray Allens of the world. Because Ray Allen was a great shooter, but he didn't get his own shot most of the time. He was in the offense. He was a knockdown shooter when you would drive and kick it.
Yeah.
and Steph and Klay, they had, time and again, in game seven and in game six, they would take a dribble move, and they would cross over the big man and get him flat-footed, and they just launch it over a seven-foot guy stretching out his enormous arm. And there was no fear, and it would go in. It was incredible. In game six, I have their full stat line. Well, not full, but the important stat lines. Steph, which people are probably going to overlook over the course of the years, Steph in game six had 31 points, 10 rebounds, and 9 assists. He almost had a 30-10-10 game, which is incredible.
Well, it's funny that you say that because I had no idea. And
right.
I've been watching the coverage all the time. Like, right. When I wake up, I'm seeing the coverage of the game, and they don't talk about it.
Yeah.
They're not talking about Curry, you know, even though he had an off-shooting night, he still dropped 30 points.
Still had 30 points. And Klay did have 41. He was 11 of 18 from three-point land. And he had 4 rebounds. His 41 points was the third most ever in a road elimination game in the last 50 years. LeBron had 45 in 2012. I think that was against the Clippers. Celtics. At the Celtics. Yeah, I think that was that game. And George Gervin had 42 in the 79 conference finals.
Man.
And then Klay Thompson with 41, which is that's impressive. That's impressive company. You cannot get better company than that.
Well, I think that, you know, with that performance from Game 6, you know, everyone kind of thought, oh, the Warriors have it. They have Game 7 now because they've won two in a row after basically being put up against the wall and they were saying their last words before it was time for them to come back and win. And, you know, back in the Bay Area, Game 7 comes around, and, you know, they kind of come out the same way they were in the previous games. They're letting OKC do what they want to do early.
Well, I don't know how much it was Golden State letting them do what they want to do. OKC looked like they had in the previous games, aside from that final aside from that final 5 minutes in Game 6 and their lackluster performance in Game 5. In the three games that they won, that's how they looked in the first half of Game 7. And you're like, oh boy, this looks like the Warriors are going to have to claw this one out as the game progressed. But then you hit halftime, and I guess maybe Billy Donovan just gave like the worst halftime talk in history or something. I don't know what it was.
I watched on TV. They looked riled up. I don't know how much that was good, but they were riled up.
Because they came out, and the Warriors just took it to them almost immediately.
I think it was the fact that Steve Kerr told his guys, look, you're trying to go at these guys physically when you're smarter than them.
Right.
And I think he said that, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, in the locker room, the little bit they showed on TNT, and they came out and they were, yeah, we're better. Let's prove it.
Right. And on a dime, I think the quarter was like 29-14, I think was the quarter split for the third quarter. And at that point, you're like, man, it's going to take some effort by the Thunder to gather themselves and get back in this game. And to their credit, well, to Kevin Durant's credit, he brought them back within four. He did. Yeah. And, it kept...
Late. Very late.
It was, what, I think with
a minute and a half left,
they were down to a four-point lead for the Warriors. And then, you know what happens. Then Klay Thompson goes down and hits a three. And then Steph Curry hits a three. And then Steph Curry puts out that just... The horse had broken his leg, and he finished the job. That's what happened with that three with, like, I don't know, it was like 20 seconds left, and they're already up by six.
Well, yeah, and I think that it just goes to prove that, Maurice Spates is the smartest man in basketball because of his tweet. He said, y'all have never seen a 73-win team. Y'all have never seen, back-to-back MVP or whatever he said about...
No, unanimous MVP.
Unanimous MVP. And then he said, he didn't say it, but kind of predicted they'd come back and win, and they did. Mm-hmm. So, just looking back the day after the series, it's hard for me to believe that the Warriors are in the finals right now. Because they were down 3-1.
They're down 3-1.
It looked over.
And it was a heavy 3-1.
They were getting hammered. Even though the score lines may not show each one getting hammered, they were getting thumped.
It does for those two games in OKC. They didn't show up. And Draymond Green was all out of sorts.
And it's kind of amazing to me that a skinny little shooting guard from Davidson, and a shooting or a point guard from Davidson and a shooting guard from Washington State are leading this Warriors team to what they could potentially be back-to-back champs. And if you would have told me 4 years ago that the Warriors would be back-to-back champions at any point, I would have said, yeah, right.
Yeah, because they'd been nothing for so long.
The rise of this team has been astronomical, just under Kerr's reign. I mean, who was their coach right before Kerr?
Mark Jackson.
Yeah, Mark Jackson. He was not a bad coach.
No.
They weren't that bad. And then it's like when Steve Kerr came in, they immediately thought, we're the best team in basketball. Let's prove it.
Mm-hmm.
And say what people want about the MVP race. I know we've discussed this. But I think Curry deservedly got it just because of the records he broke over the season.
Right, right.
And I think he's going to prove it in these playoffs, which I think he has. That he deserves, he's the best player in the league when it comes time to prove it.
Well, I mean, it's now time to prove it, and he's going up against the guy who's trying to show that he is always the most important player in the NBA, LeBron James. But that's a discussion for another time. I think the big story that isn't immediately involved in the finals is Kevin Durant's summer, because he's going to be a free agent from OKC. And I thought it was slightly uncouth of the the reporters to come out, and that was the first question he was asked when he got into the conference room. The first question. I will say he handled it more gracefully than Cam Newton handled his Super Bowl, but they're trying to get an emotional response out of these guys. They're trying to get them to say something inflammatory, and it's not the greatest thing. It's not the greatest thing about sports writing for me.
No, and I don't really appreciate when they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is he going to say? If he says the wrong thing, he's upset an entire fan base. Whether it's the organization he's a part of or a future one.
Right.
And they want that, right? Like you said, they want that emotional answer. They want the rise in the athlete. They want him to come out and say, yeah, I'm leaving. I'm done with this. That's what they want because that makes great press.
And then
not who Durant is.
And then they can go out and say, oh, look at him. Look at how irresponsibly he acted in answering this question. They want players to make a mistake so that they can have days of writing about it.
Yeah, it's an easy story to continue
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
because then you can speculate. Then you can make your predictions. I mean, the first day you reported it, and then you've got at least two or three more days of the same story.
Because you're gonna have the apology or the rebuttal from whatever he comes up with the next day or later that day, depending on when you get this information. And then you've got the response from the team itself. And it's just a news cycle for something that was, in the heat of the moment anyways.
Yeah. And, he is a free agent, an unrestricted free agent at that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he's allowed to do what he wants.
Right.
He's allowed to talk to who he wants. He's allowed to visit who he wants. So this could make for an interesting time. I put down three likely destinations, and I said, and I'll tell you what percent I think that's going to happen, but I think the Celtics, Oklahoma City, and the Lakers are his three most likely destinations. I read today that the Celtics are going to make a huge push to make him their guy, and they're going to do whatever it takes.
I mean, they're already a good team with a fantastic, incredible coach.
Yeah, a young, incredible coach at that.
Well, their entire squad is young. I think they have the youngest, behind the 76ers, I believe, they have the youngest squad in the NBA.
Yeah, and I think that if Durant is sold on that, their future, their present is already not bad.
But they made the playoffs this year.
Yeah, and if you can sell him on the future, that could be a dangerous organization. Then mm-hmm. I talked about him staying at OKC.
Right.
The lure of, oh, we made it this far, we could do it again. My thoughts on that are, I don't think that's going to be enough to make him stay.
Well, okay.
I don't think so.
There's that, but then there's also the enormous piles of money that he can make more of by staying in OKC.
Well, if he signs a one-year deal,
a two-year deal with a one-year player option.
Yeah. If he does that, he'll make bank. But does he really want to? I mean, this Westbrook and Durant partnership has not really been, I use that word lightly, but partnership, because they each kind of want to get their own. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the franchise is big enough for both of them, because they're going to have to pay some of these other guys, because they, they seem to love Steven Adams, even though I'm not his biggest fan. I think he gets away with a lot down low. That's not taken away from his performances in the playoffs. I thought he had good performances.
He needs to improve on the offensive side of the ball, absolutely. But he's definitely a good energy guy and a tremendous offensive rebounder, which is something very valuable to teams.
I just don't think Westbrook, if they play the Westbrook card, hey, you guys can be partners again, I don't think that's going to be enough. I think it will all depend on what they're able to pitch. Money talks, obviously. But another team I put down as a likely possibility, these are kind of going together for opposite reasons, is mm-hmm. the Lakers and Washington.
DC, the whole Scotty Brooks, he's from there. One thing I will say about OKC is that he may do that one-year option just because next year there are, I think, Ibaka, Westbrook and Adams are all free agents next year. Not this, not this summer, but next summer. So if he takes that 1 year deal, he can coordinate with them somewhat. And then, I mean, because if he takes a big deal right now, which is not a terrible idea for him because he just had a major foot injury, and 7-footers are, you know, viable. They're liable to be injured at any point with their enormous bodies and everything. The safe bet would be to take a large deal where you can make the most money, which would be OKC. Now, you're saying that you think that Washington, D.C. and the Lakers are the next two most possible. Which one do you put first? Do you put the Celtics or Thunder first on your list there?
Well, do you want me to go all in order or just those two?
Just read them off in order that you have them right now.
Okay, right now, I think the most likely destination is OKC.
I agree.
The most likely thing is for him to do what you're saying, to sign a big contract, maybe even a long-term deal, because you're right, he has been injured before, and it's easy. What do players want? They want the deals that keep them getting the money the longest.
Right, because even if you get injured, all NBA contracts are guaranteed, so they're going to be paying you that money no matter what.
Exactly. Then I have Washington. I think the allure of a homecoming plus teaming up with John Wall could be very interesting. And Bradley Beal's there, a pretty good shooting guard. They're pretty young, too.
Yeah. D.C., I mean, I could see it for the homecoming storyline like you're talking, but it's not like he's been there previously, you know? I mean, he grew up there, but he's never been a part of the Washington Wizards organization.
Well, yeah.
Like LeBron, but I mean, like LeBron was with that, the whole homecoming thing. I don't know if he'll do that. And the situation in Washington it's decent, but you have John Wall, he's not a great shooter, for one thing. And number two, I would say he is a better point guard, as in a pure point guard, than Westbrook. But he definitely tries to get his own buckets. And we all know Bradley Beal likes to get his own buckets. And the problem with Bradley Beal is he sits out more games than he plays, it seems, most seasons. He always has like a wrist injury or an ankle injury or something, and he's out. And that really hurts the team.
Well, I think that Wall is a better passer than Westbrook. Well, I should say he's a more generous passer.
Yeah.
I think he would be more willing to give Durant a 40-point night than himself. And I think that could be an allure, because what does Westbrook do? He doesn't really pass that much. And when he does, it's when he's up top dribbling, you know, not going anywhere. Because 90% of the time, he's going to the basket. And I made the comparison the other night that I think he plays more physically and a little bit more gifted and less injury prone, like a young D. Rose. I think that the comparisons there are very similar, because D. Rose, his problem was is that he could not give up, you know, that mentality of go to the basket, get the and one.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that first significant injury to Westbrook is going to make him back up, or we'll see him continue to get hurt like Rose did for a while.
Right.
And I don't wish that upon him. I think he's an excellent talent. But I think that John Wall would be better for Durant, just because he's more generous with his passes. He's more willing to, you know, take the step back behind the guy, because you don't ever hear of him being like the superstar.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great player, but he's not a superstar yet. Yeah. And I think that combo could be better than people think. And his old coach is in Washington.
Well,
that's that little extra bait.
That is an extra bait. But if you want a place with a point guard who's willing to defer, I heard this idea. It was thrown out there today during a PTI by Wilbon. The Clippers. The Clippers are on treacherous waters with Blake Griffin because of that whole scenario, and you don't know if they're going to keep him or not. They could trade him. If they can get Kevin Durant to commit to them for a long-term deal with you know, Kevin Durant, DeAndre Jordan, and Chris Paul as a big three, and then they trade out, and then they trade Blake Griffin for a ton of great role players, that team could have an instant rebuild, an instant reboot, more like, an instant reboot, and have an incredible team.
I you're right with that. I think that if that would have happened, that team instantly becomes one of the best teams in the NBA.
They already were. They already were is the thing. And it would just be – that's why it's a reboot. It's just they tweaked things majorly. But
you've got – you have now an addition of a major scorer.
Right, right. And, he,
and that's kind of what they've lacked.
Right. Well, it's he replaces Blake Griffin, but it's a completely different sort of replacement, of course, because Durant is a 3-point shooter, which is kind of where Blake Griffin is going. But you don't crowd the paint as much with Kevin Durant in there instead of Blake Griffin. Part of the problem when they ran their when they ran their big lineup for the Clippers was that the paint got crowded. And you couldn't get your drivers in there because you had both Blake Griffin and DeAndre Jordan hanging out around the basket looking for alley-oops and easy passes and dunks and things like that. And with Kevin Durant there, your spacing becomes so much wider, and you get Chris Paul in there with his crafty moves, and he can kick it out to Durant or lay it up to DeAndre. And the geometry of that basketball court works much better if you swap out Kevin Durant with Blake Griffin. Well, swap out Blake Griffin with Kevin Durant.
I think the only stumbling block to that deal is who's going to take on Blake Griffin and his contract.
Where
do you shop him to?
I think you could find plenty of teams that would want it, that would gladly take Blake Griffin, a team who's just starving for a superstar.
I for one think he'd be a good fit for the Grizzlies because Zach Randolph's getting older.
Gasol.
And Conley's an assist man.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That he goes into a situation.
Not perfect, but we need a superstar.
Yeah.
Because Marc Gasol and Conley are not stars.
You definitely need scoring as well. So yeah. There's that. However,
I don't think we'll be willing to spend that money. I don't think so. But
also,
what would you think if they were able to do? And I don't know how they do this. Maybe a sign and trade deal. Thunder to someone else. That way they get something in exchange.
Like a three-team trade?
Yeah, like a three-team trade. And I like the idea involving the Clippers.
The only thing, I will say that one other stumbling block in this is Blake Griffin's lingering quadriceps injury, which took him out of the series against the Blazers earlier this playoffs and kept him out for months and months and months during the regular season. That, if he does not get that sorted out, could be the deal breaker. But that's also a reason why the Clippers would want to get rid of him. It may take a lower price.
They could, and this could be something. Could they try and do, and this is assuming that Tim Duncan retires. What about a rebuild in San Antonio with Aldridge and Griffin down low?
Oh, man.
I mean, think about that. We're not even going to attempt to put a point guard and shooting guard there.
Well,
Kawhi Leonard, small forward, Blake Griffin, power forward, Aldridge, center. That is a team.
That geometry works pretty well because Aldridge can – they can both post up on opposite sides of the floor. No, you know what? They operate on the same side of the floor, don't they? That is a problem.
I mean, Aldridge is pretty versatile. I mean, apart from Lillard, he was the guy up there in Portland. And then he came down, and yes, he was the guy. But when you think of the Spurs, even though you don't think of minutes, you think of Duncan, you think of Ginobili, you think of Parker. And it all depends on if they go. Obviously, if they're not retiring yet, nothing happens. But I think that could be an interesting little thing if they're able to get Durant to go to the Clippers.
I don't see the Spurs making that deal. I don't see the Spurs trying to make a play for Griffin. They're also in the hunt for Durant as well, which would be scary if you had Aldridge at the center.
Would he just play shooting guard, or would Kawhi and him small forward shooting guard?
Durant? Well, I think Durant would be the four. You put LaMarcus Aldridge at the five.
Go to a small four?
Yeah.
I mean, well, he's a tall guy.
He's 6'10",
but, you know,
yeah.
Not physically big.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you could put Kawhi at the two. He guards plenty of point guards.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. I put the Lakers down just because Kobe's
they have tons of money.
A massive amount of money.
They've got
and they
tons
need
of
a
money.
Superstar.
They do have tons of money in L.A. And it's the Lakers. There's yeah. always that draw. But I think the Lakers are waiting for Kevin Love.
I think the perfect fit, if it were to happen, is your idea with the Clippers. But I think the most likely destination is for him to stay.
The most likely destination is for there not to be one. Yeah. That's yeah. probably what it boils down to. Of course, the Warriors also have the money to make a play at Kevin Durant.
That would be nuts.
As does the Miami Heat, which is it's an idea. If you can keep Whiteside.
Well, and the thing is does LeBron James want to try and get Durant if he tries to do another super team? Because there's talk that he's trying to get some guys on the same team again and make another super team.
They're going to restart the Supersonics and all move to Seattle. That's what's going to happen. I
just don't know where they go. I mean, you'd have to convince a franchise to do what the Heat did. But they also were lucky because Dwayne Wade was already there in his
right,
prime.
Right, right.
So that's a different situation is how are you going to be able to build a super team anywhere right now? I mean, you can do it, but where? They'd have to release and trade a lot of guys.
Yeah.
Don't think Durant would be a part of it. I think he'll stay, but I think if he were to leave, it would be, I'll make this prediction, I think it will be to a team that we don't expect, if he does leave. I think the Clippers may make a play because it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But that all depends on someone leaving.
Blake
Griffin leaving. We'll just have to see. I think it's going to be a really interesting scenario just with Durant. Not even the whole free agent.
Right.
There's tons of big
players. We already listed all those free agents. I mean, LeBron could possibly be a free agent this summer.
I think he will be. But I think he'll probably just resign.
Because he can get so much more money.
It's always just a crazy time every few years when you have those big name NBA free agents.
Well, no, everybody coordinated their contracts so they'd be coming up during these couple of years because of the new TV deal. I mean, that's 5 years ago. We knew that this money was coming, so everybody's like, "Hey, I want to be in there for that money." So we're just in a very volatile time for the NBA going through these next couple off seasons, where things obviously have and can continue to shift because LeBron went back to Cleveland. That was the big move. That was the really big move. But this summer we could see a lot more of that. Oh, Aldridge going to the Spurs. I mean, that wasn't a lesser, but it still shifted the power.
I think that the interesting part of this summer, take away Durant, LeBron, you know, the big name guys. Who do the small market teams, who do they go after? Like the Memphis Grizzlies, you know, the Indiana Pacers. I mean, small, like mid-level.
Yeah, it's a small market, teams. Having all these superstars in the free agent pool actually helps them in that sense because all the big market teams who can afford to go into the luxury tax year after year after year go after these big guys with these big contracts, and it leaves all the, you know, the role players and marginal starters and all the guys who make a difference in the game, they're just not the superstars. It leaves them wanting because they're not being pursued like they could have been in other off seasons. So, you know, in a way, while it makes big teams get better, and not big as in good, but big as in they have tons of money, big teams get better, it also helps the small teams all over the place. Basically, more money helps people in the NBA. Having more money available helps everybody. A rising tide, the rising tide floats all ships or something like that. There's a phrase or something like that. So it's going to be a pretty crazy summer, as we've all touched on, and as Kevin Durant alone has illustrated in this short little segment that we've had here. Other news from over the weekend, there was that whole Indy 500 thing, the greatest spectacle in racing, the largest single-day sporting event in the world. If you follow our Twitter account, you saw that one of us was there. Spoiler, it was me. I was there.
The other was looking for it on TV and apparently missed it because it was mislabeled. So one of us saw it, the other did not. And it's my first year out of town that it, you know, yeah, because in Indianapolis, this was the first year that people have been able to watch it live
for,
on TV.
Yeah, for a long time.
It's like 1952 or something. I'm not in Indianapolis at the moment, and I still didn't watch it. And I was excited to because I had never been able to watch it because I'd been in town every year. And I was getting ready to watch it because we actually, I had a study hall with him, I know.
Oh.
But we know a guy who went to our high school who actually raced in it, Connor Daly. He raced in a number 18 car.
He has the worst luck at the Indy 500, I will say. And he will admit it, too. He did as much on Facebook. He qualified middle of the pack. I think it was like ninth row or something. And he got caught up in a wreck before the century mark as far as laps are concerned. And, you know, he was out. And last year he had that mechanical failure early in the race, and he was out. He's a hometown kid, and it's just sad that he makes it every year into the race, but he never seems to be able to complete it.
Well, this was his first year with a full-time IndyCar ride.
Right,
Last year, has he raced the last 2 years or just this year? Or last year, I mean.
I know he's raced the past, I know he raced last year and this year. I cannot recall if he raced 3 years ago.
Well, he used to be in F2 or G2, whatever the second tier of F1 is. He raced in that for a while. And he came over here because he had a dream to drive in the Indy 500. And he got a car for like one race. And that was it was just last year that he had that problem, the mechanical problem.
Right.
And then this year he had high hopes that he was going to do better. And as he said, the worst luck.
Mm-hmm. He was moving up through the field, too. He had gotten up to 19th the last time I heard, because I was at the race. So it's amazing being at the race because it's so hard to tell what's actually going on.
And you look at the track and you go, oh, I think cars just went by. I don't know. Well, there they are on the other end.
Well, you can't see them because there's a golf field in the middle of the racetrack. There's the Indianapolis Motor Speedway is a 2.5 mile track with huge straightaways, and the enormity of the thing is quite staggering. And the amount of people there this year, he's talking about the blackout earlier, it's because it's an incentive for us to go to the race here in Indianapolis. If you do not sell out the Indy 500, they do not let you watch the race live. So this year we sold out the Indy 500 for the first time since like 1950 whatever. And we had the ability to watch the race live. So
all those people who spent money on tickets, people at home got to watch the same thing, and it was probably way cooler inside, too.
It was definitely way cooler. It is hot at that racetrack. I heard numbers like 350,000 people, maybe 400,000 people at that place. Because you get to the infield, and it's hard to count all the people, because they move around and they're having a good time, so to speak. Let me tell you, the guy behind me sitting today, he had a good time. Before the race even started, he threw away a gallon-sized baggie with 5 empty Bud Light cans in it. That was before the race even started. He was well-sauced before the green flag dropped.
Sounds like he was gearing up for a good day.
Yeah, well, he had it. He was a race fan, let me tell you.
Was he a NASCAR fan?
No. He may have just been like an Indy 500 fan. I think what he was. He just paid his attention to the Indy 500 every year.
It's like those people who only pay attention to like the Tostitos Fiesta Bowl. That's the only game I watch. Die Hard.
That's weird. That's a weird one.
Hey, people do it.
Anyways, I was in turn four. I couldn't quite see the front straightaway, but it was a good experience to be there. I wanted to be there for the 100th running, which was this year. I don't do well with heat. I get very sweaty and things, and it's not a comfortable situation for me or anyone around me. So it's not something I would do every year. Also, I don't like people. So there's that.
So good experience overall.
Yeah. No, it was...
Out of 10, would you recommend?
I would recommend everybody go there at least once, just because there's so much, and it is... The proceedings are very nice. And they have a good setup. They have TV screens that you can see from all seats. There's a couple big TV screens you can see from all seats so that you can kind of figure out what's going on. And the speakers are loud enough that you can hear what's going on over the race cars, which is impressive because they are loud. I was glad I had headphones. Not headphones, but earplugs.
Now, out of 10. 8 out of 10?
Out of 10? I'd probably say 7 out of 10. But that's just me. I don't like people. It was hot. If it was any hotter, though, the number would go...
Take away the people. Take away the heat.
With each degree, that number would go down. If you're into racing, I would definitely go. Like I said, everybody should go at least once just to see what it's like. Because there's a lot of fun stuff to do. There's the Snake Pit, which is... it used to be quite a rowdy place to be. They would set up these big pyramids of things, and they would collapse and kill people and stuff. So that's been tamed in the recent years. And now there's a music festival that goes on during the race inside in the infield called Snake Pit. And Skrillex was there. He was there. Skrillex was there yesterday. Not yesterday, Sunday.
Well, that sounds like a grand old time.
Mm-hmm.
While I missed it, sitting on my couch in a beautiful, beautiful... Like, I think that it was 68 degrees in my home. Oh, it's fantastic.
Wow, you keep it cold. You pay for that air conditioning?
You have to. It's hot in Nashville.
It is hot in Nashville. I know that. I do know that. Well, another thing you missed this weekend was Jordan Spieth seemingly coming back to grips with who he is. He played at, oh, goodness, I can't remember now. It was an invitational for a food supply company, I believe, in Fort Worth, Texas. So he got his win in his home state. And the impressive thing was he shot even par on the front nine. Then on the back nine, he went birdie, 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 bogey, par, par, birdie, birdie, birdie. That was his back nine.
Oof.
So to say that he ended well was an understatement because those weren't easy birdies. He chipped in from off the green. He was well below it and chipped up on top of it, and it rolled in for at the 17th and the 18th. These were the only holes I caught because it was after the race, so we got home pretty late. And then on the 18th, he made a 32-foot putt when he had 3 putts to win it, and he hit his birdie 32-foot putt to sink it. And, I have a stat for him. He has the second most wins for any player ever under the age of 23. The guy above him is Horton Smith with 14. He has, the Dean and DeLuca Invitational. There it is. He has 8, and Tiger Woods had only 7 wins on the PGA Tour before turning 23. So he's now surpassed Tiger before turning 23. And he still has until, I think, next April before he turns 23.
Yeah, I mean, what he's done at such a young age already, I mean, he had a shot to win 4 majors in a year.
Mm-hmm.
A realistic shot.
He had a shot to win a major this year.
Yeah, I think that he's going to, I don't ever want to say it because it's early, you know, I think he has the best chance of any golfer in the last several years to finally break that, 18 major record?
I'm not sure.
I think it's 18, because Tiger's sitting at, 12, 14 maybe? Tiger has quite a few, but he's not going to get it. Tiger's probably done. But Spieth is probably the most humble superstar when it comes to golf.
Yeah,
Every time you talk to him, it's like, wow, this kid's like a genuinely nice guy.
Yeah.
And, he's Under Armour's main guy, you know.
Aside from Steph.
Yeah. For golf, he's got awesome gear, and he makes Under Armour look real good.
Well, it's funny because you watch all these golfers and, you know, they'll have like, they'll have six or seven different logos plastered all over the body. This one guy had chef's cut beef jerky. Huge. It was like the size of an index card on his shirt front, on the front of his shirt. And you watch Jordan Spieth, and he literally just has an Under Armour hat. He has a small chest logo for Under Armour. His gloves are Under Armour. He has Under Armour as his only sponsor because they pay him enough money that that's all he needs to do. And probably also he's contractually obligated to not have any other sponsors except for like his golf balls and clubs and things like that because Under Armour doesn't make those. So it's funny to watch him walk around in his relatively unadorned attire amongst the peacocking other guys. To your point, Jack Nicklaus has 18 major golf championships. Tiger Woods has 14. And his last major was in 2008, nearly 10 years ago. Oof.
Wow.
The U.S. Open in 2008.
Man, was that when he beat Rocco Mediate? Do you remember that? Rocco Mediate, the guy who no one thought would even have a chance to win it, has Tiger has to make, I think, a birdie putt to get a chance to go into a playoff, and he sinks it. It could be...
That was when it was when he was hurt, right? He was walking around with his driver as a cane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember the famous line, I knew he'd hit it. I just knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about Tiger hitting that last putt. And I think Tiger won in like two holes.
Yeah, I think I do remember that now.
But yeah, I just thought it was, it's hard to believe that's been 8 years.
Yeah.
Since he's won a major. I mean, we've kind of been hyping him up to come back and to be the old Tiger. Like, will he ever come back? And at this point, it's looking like no. You know, at one point in time, you would have thought, oh, Tiger's going to beat this major record with ease.
And then all that drama
came, and then his nagging injuries.
Uh-huh.
I mean, he has fallen so far down the golf ladder. You don't even think of him until someone kind of mentions him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're watching the game through the matches, and you go, "Why? Like, there's Jason Day. There's, you know, Ricky Fowler. It's like Rory McIlroy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Spieth." And then you kind of have that thought that you're like, "Why does this look weird?" And it's because Tiger's not there,
right?
And I think that Spieth has that chance to be the new Tiger per se.
Well,
an exciting golfer who wins big tournaments.
Success-wise, he can be the new Tiger, but
as far as personality, no, I'm not.
Well, no, I'm not saying. I'm saying culturally, I don't think he can be that because he's just another. My brother is a cynic, as am I, and I was watching golf, and he was here, and he said all these guys look like senator's sons, because they were in Texas, and I actually he's right. I didn't see any other ethnicity or nationality besides a white person there. So, I mean, in that instance, he was right. But the game of golf is growing. But Jordan Spieth is not, he is white. So he cannot be Tiger Woods as far as Tiger Woods was to golf. He opened up to a whole section of the nation that would otherwise be unengaged.
I would agree with that. I think that what made Tiger so special is that, you know, before all that happened, everyone loved him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just the fact that he was a likable guy.
Right.
And then until you found out he's a terrible person. But, you know, before that, you thought, wow, this is a good guy. He's a role model, good with kids. You know, and then it's like, boom, changes in an instant what you think about him.
Public perception just shattered and... Yeah, and... You know, he may be doing it right now because I always kind of felt like he was rushing back from all of his other injuries. And this time, he's definitely not. He's definitely not trying to rush back.
Well, I think part of the problem with him is that instead of rehabbing injuries, he would just adjust his swing over and over and over again. Like, he's had a new swing, like, each of the last 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just trying to rehab slowly. Coming back
right,
he would just change his swing with a new swing coach. It's like, just rehab. Your swing was working so well. But one thing, I'm glad he took a lot of power off.
Because
that was killing his knees. because he was putting so much force behind the ball.
And his back.
Yeah, that it was just deteriorating at a young age. Young, I say. But, you know, a youngish age, especially for golf.
Yeah, for golf, he's definitely young.
He was just fading so quickly because he's so worried about hammering the ball down the fairway. And to his credit, he did. But the problem is that, look at him now, he can barely walk. He's got so much pain in his knees and back.
Mm-hmm. And that's why Spieth has such a good shot to be as successful as Tiger.
It's so pure.
Well, he doesn't hammer it. He doesn't hammer it down the fairways. He doesn't try. He's not like Jason Day hammers it. Rory McIlroy hammers it. Those guys really, they hit it hard. But Jordan Spieth, he's not a hammerer. He's not a hammerer. He picks his spots. That's what he does. He picks his spots and he goes for them. And he knows where his spots are.
Yeah, the thing he does really well is he really puts the club through the ball well. Like, he lets the club do a lot of that work. You know, he just swings it and he lets the club do it. And the thing that helps him with that is that he's not stressing his body over whacking this ball an extra 30 yards. He's worried about, well, I can lay it up here and then chip it in or get close enough to make a par after this bad hole. And that's what he's good at, recovery. And that's going to be good for him for many, many years, is that the ability to recover so well.
Well, that and the fact that he's already so accomplished at Augusta. I know this year he had that meltdown on the 12th, but if you look at the results as to what happened, he has finished in the top two the past 3 years at Augusta.
Yeah.
He was in second 3 years ago. He won it last year, and he finished in solo second again this year. Because even after he made that, I think it was a 9, right? Was it a 9 on a par 3?
It was an 8 or 9.
He recovered. He came back, and he was still fighting. He still had a chance to win it in the end. Which is, it's something you don't see from a lot of guys. He had his bad hole, and he started to come back from it. Which is why I thought a lot of that was overreaction. Because he still came back from it. As a 22-year-old, as a guy who most people would not call mature, he did, you could already see him coming back from that 12th already.
Yeah. And the thing is that you're right. It's at 22, it's really hard to get a read on him. Because any other 22-year-old doing that, you know, that collapse, they go, oh, it's because of his youth. But now you're looking at Spieth and you go, he's 22 and he's really mature. He's played a lot of professional golf at 22.
That's a good point. Most people would say, oh, man, in a couple of years he won't have that problem. But people were literally attacking his game when that came about. They're like, oh, what's his issue? What's the problem with him? It's not, well, for one, he's 22.
Yeah.
You guys, can you cut him some slack?
He's so successful at a young age, it's hard to compare him to anyone.
Yeah.
It's like when, you know, different sports, it's like when LeBron James came into the NBA and was still so good, even at, what, 18?
18.
People were going, you know, he'd have a bad game and people say, oh, he's overrated. It's like, he was 18 doing things that 27-year-olds couldn't do.
Right.
And I think that, you know, in a different look at it, it's kind of the same thing, is that we have not seen this ability from a young golfer like this consistently. Because Rory was pretty good when he was, when he first came about, he was pretty good. The problem is that he's so inconsistent.
He has a temper. That's his problem. Yeah. He's got a temper. He's a fiery temper. He's got that North Irish temper.
I think the big thing for Spieth moving forward is how close-knit he is with his family and his longtime girlfriend.
And caddy.
I think those relationships keep him strong.
Yeah.
I think that the behind-the-scenes, the things we don't see are the things that help him the most, is because he's comfortable. Mm-hmm. He knows he's got a family and a girlfriend who love him and a caddy that's there for him, and he trusts his caddy. He listens to his caddy, everything he says. I was listening to it in the Masters before his collapse. He was asking, what do you think, what club? And he goes, you've hit the shot before, here you go. And he hands him like a 6. And he just bombs it within a couple feet of the green.
Right.
And you're like, wow, all right, there you go.
Well, my brother's girlfriend, when they were in town watching golf with me, she doesn't know a lot about golf. So I was explaining it to her, and she's like, well, who's that? Who's the guy carrying the clubs? Is he just like a guy? I'm like, oh, no. And I was looking for the analogy, and I came up with it. He's the co-pilot. And in the case of Jordan Spieth, it's really like they're almost on equal terms mentally. It's just that he has to pull the trigger in this metaphor.
Yeah, and I think that's good. It's because, you know, not a lot of people see that with golf. They just think, oh, this guy carries the club. If right. you look at some no. of the best golfers in the world, they listen. They right. look at this guy in the eyes and go, you're right, I was wrong. Let's use that. Let's go for right. that angle. And they adjust to it, and mm-hmm. they hit a nicer shot. I mean, that's why you see when they hit that nice shot, they high-five their caddy.
That's right.
They're not just putting their head down going, hey, thanks, good shot. They're going, hey, good call, high-five, fist bump.
That's right.
And it's a relationship. It's not just it's not a work relationship. They're almost you almost have to be best friends with the caddy.
Right.
To become successful. And that's what helped Tiger for so long, is him and his caddy were close.
Yeah.
And then when that collapsed too, it's like Tiger's just been gone.
In shambles.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope that Spieth has a nice long career. I think he will. I think he's got a bright future. He'll have a chance to win a major every year. Because the Masters is always at Augusta, and he's already shown us that he's accomplished there. All right, well, before we go, we've got a new segment. I've got a segment now. That's right. Here it is.
It's new segment alert.
We've kind of alluded to it. We've poked fun at this before. It's the stupid SportsCenter stat of the day. Here we go. All right?
Let's hear it.
In baseball, when teams are losing by six, entering the bottom of the ninth. Since 2010, these teams are 5-2,813.
Wow! What a stat!
And my saying to that is, you're expecting a team to score seven runs in the bottom of the ninth?
No. You know what the best part is? Is that was probably an intern who had to sit and go through every game that have that score line and look up and just tally. No, they don't have computers up in Bristol, Connecticut.
That's right. They've got like a Dewey Decimal System, but for sports. It's all index cards.
I mean, this is what we're talking about. What? Duh.
Duh is the answer. Oh, you're down by sixth going into the bottom of the ninth? I've already turned the channel when you're going into the bottom of the ninth, down by six. The bottom of the eighth, down by six. I already turned it off an inning before.
It's one of those stats you hear and you go, really? Huh. Have no idea that would be a stat. Like, oh man, I'm looking forward to this segment, and I hope all of you listeners are, because there are some great stats.
There's some gems.
You just go, who in their right mind thought it was a good idea not only to look this up, but to air it?
Yeah.
Put it online.
That's right. So just for your personal edification, remember, when you're down by six going into the bottom of the ninth as a baseball team, the odds are you're going to lose.
There's a chance, though. A very, very...
Wow. The chance, it's... What is it?
But there's a chance. That's what you should learn. The positive side of this stat is that there's a small chance.
Let me calculate real quick. I can get this.
I think that this is going to be a great number, and you should write this on your baseball cleats. Write it on your bat. Write it in your glove. This is how good of a chance you have when you're losing by six in the bottom of the ninth.
It's a .1. It's a 0.2% chance.
Write that down, kids. 0.2% chance you'll win a game down by six in the ninth.
There you go.
With that stupid, dumb
ESPN stat of the day. Yeah, this has been Xander Fadley.
This has been Always Insightful.
And this has been another episode of Meet Me in the Middle. See you next time.
See y'all.
Bye.